Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Everywhere you go, you'll meet people who are eager to tell you that traditional diets are the key to good health and longevity. But how traditional do we need to go? Can we stick with meat-heavy paleo fare? Are we better off with a plant-based menu? Or should we go all the way back to nibbling on grubs and crickets? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Human diets have changed a lot over the course of history as a factor of our changing biology and our widely varying cultures. As my guest will tell us, there may not be one right way to eat, but many, pioneered by people who lived long before the first diet book or Vitamix or Whole Foods. Stephen Lay is visiting professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Ottawa. His new book is called 100 Million Years of Food, What Our Ancestors Ate and Why It Matters Today. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You're a proponent of traditional diets, but it did not escape your notice when you visited Vietnam, where your parents were born, that you are considerably taller and heavier than your peers there, which would seem to suggest an advantage to the way we eat here and now in North America. But there's a catch.
Yes, that's right. So on a Canadian or North American diet, I was exposed to a lot of meat and milk and a lot of calories in general while I was growing up. And this probably gave me an advantage in terms of my height. And so when I went back to Vietnam, I noticed that I was quite a bit taller than the peers of my age. But at the same time, it's quite possible that having such a heavy meat and milk-rich diet probably gave me an acne condition, which most of my peers in Vietnam don't have. And I also happen to have thinning hair, again, which is probably linked to the meat and milk-heavy diet that I had. And in terms of overall conditions, it's likely that being taller does not necessarily help you live longer.
It can, being stronger and taller and more fertile in youth can be associated with eating this way. But in terms of the cost in longevity, is that only for people who become overweight or obese, or is there maybe a cost in longevity for everybody?
Yes, being taller is has been linked to different kinds of cancers. So it could be a health risk. There hasn't been strong evidence to show that people who are taller are going to live shorter lives, but it's possible that the quality of life could be compromised.
All right, let's talk about what we know of traditional ways of eating, which clearly would have been different depending on where people lived in the world. Overall, though, how would our ancestors' daily calorie consumption compare with ours?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So it depends on which part of the world that you're talking about. So in some parts of the world, they had access to a lot of food. For example, on the Pacific West Coast, they had rich salmon runs there. On the other hand, people who lived in parts of the desert areas of the world probably had quite a bit less, fewer calories. And so there was quite a difference in the calorie intake around the world. But on average, it seems that what we're eating today is not quite that different from the overall average calorie intake of our ancestors.
One significant difference, though, is that they moved a lot more than we do today, on the order of like 5 to 8 miles a day, many scholars think, for the average person.
That's correct. Yes, they had to move around constantly to find food, to find mates, to set up their shelters, and so on. So they were always on the move, but it wasn't a vigorous movement necessarily. They weren't running around all the time, but they were walking around a lot.
All right, let's talk about food. If we want to eat more like people who dwelled in caves, we might get a juicy steak occasionally, but it seems that more often we will make room on our plates for nibbling little insects and things like that.
Yes, that's right. Finding game meat was a constant goal. And if they could find a large mammal, then they would have a feast and set aside that meat for quite some time if it was necessary. But those were on the rare occasions. And for the most part, people were had to subsist with smaller animals. And this became truer over time. As humans became better at hunting, we steadily reduced large mammal populations around the world. And so over time, we went from eating large mammals more frequently to more recently in time when large mammals were quite scarce around the world and people had to subsist on smaller mammals and also plant foods as well, and insects.
All right, insects, there's such a taboo in our culture, certainly, but there are parts of the world where people don't really think this is so bizarre. And yet, you discover that even in places where insects were part of the traditional diet, it's not like they're being served in every restaurant.
Yes, that's right. So, for example, in Thailand, insects are still eaten fairly widely, particularly by rural populations and by the older generations. Younger people who are growing up these days in Thailand who are exposed to a lot more modern food, especially in Western food, they're not so eager to dig into insects like their ancestors. But overall in Thailand, there's still a strong acceptance for eating insect foods. But in places like China and Vietnam, where insects were once a large part of the diet, there has been they eat a lot less these days. And for example, in the case of Vietnam, a strong case could be made that once the French came in, that they introduced notions about eating insects, suggesting that insects are not palatable food. And so the Vietnamese steadily shifted towards foods that the French considered to be fine dining, and they moved away from the insects.
So they would eat escargot, but not crickets.
That's right.
It does seem that there is, you know, people are sort of weirded out by this if they've never tried it. Tell us about your experience with eating things like grubs and crickets, some of which were still alive when you took that bite.
That's right. Palm worms are a kind of larvae, beetle larvae, and they're quite popular in many parts of the tropical world. And as it turns out, if you eat them fresh, while they're still living and they're still moving, they taste wonderful. But you have to get over the psychological block first. And so when I tried my live palmer, it was dipped. I had to dip it in fish sauce, and then hold it by the head so that the grub would not bite my tongue. And then you pull off the body with your teeth, and it's hard. It's hard to get over that the feeling of disgust and fear, but it tastes quite good.
Is it something you would want to have again if you had access to it?
Definitely. If I could have a constant supply of live palm worm weevils or larvae, I would like to have this every day.
Steve, is there reason to believe that hunter-gatherers typically prepared and ate what we would consider something like a scheduled meal rather than just nibbling on foods as they encountered them?
What do you mean by a scheduled meal, like
regular occasions? Yeah, did they eat on regular occasions, or did they, say, you know, find a blackberry bush or some grubs or whatever and then eat as they found those things?
Yeah, there's wide variation in eating habits. So some populations would have just eaten on the spot as they walked around. And in other populations where food was more constant, they could have had regular meals. So it depended on the food supply. But, for example, I recall that when I was traveling in Papua New Guinea, some of my friends came across a child who was carrying a bandicoot, kind of a marsupial, and it was decided that we would eat on the spot. So they bought the bandicoot and then skinned it and boiled it, and I flavored it with some chili sauce, and we had it right there. So, yes, it depends on the supply of food available to that population.
Our distant ancestors had to spend a lot of time figuring out what was edible and what was potentially toxic, and, of course, a lot of plant matter would be toxic. I've always wondered about how people got over what would seem to have been a real disincentive for spicy foods like chilies, which, you know, if you put them on your tongue, they would give you an indication that this is not something you should eat a great deal of.
Right. So one of the theories about how people got over eating spicy food was that it helps to reduce the risk of food poisoning from bacteria. So people who had to consume spicy food, they would, by this theory, they would have ended up eventually liking it because they got sick less often. That's the theory, and I'm not sure if I buy that completely. There could be other ways that people become habituated to spicy foods. And it turns out that humans, in general, do a lot of things that other animals would consider to be aversive or unpleasant. So, for example, people also, some people anyways, like to climb mountains, rock climbing. And again, there's a lot of reasons why a person would not want to do that at first. But once you get over it, it becomes kind of addictive. And I think there's some quality like that with spicy food.
What caused our ancestors to shift from hunter-gatherer lifestyles to agriculture, and what were the costs and benefits of this in terms of our health?
Yeah, there's still a raging debate about the various factors that cause humans to shift from hunter-gathering to agriculture. Among those ideas, I present a new idea in my book, and that idea is that our ancestors became really good at hunting to the extent that they were able to wipe out a large most of the large mammals. And as a result, we became more dependent on eating leaner and leaner meat. And it turns out that humans can only consume 40% of their calories from protein. So that means that if you can just think about it, eating a really lean steak or eating rabbit or something like that, it doesn't taste good. And so once we wiped out enough of those large mammals, then I think there would have been a strong incentive for people to find other kinds of foods that were more palatable. And I think that was a contributing factor to why people started shifting towards agriculture to find food to replace the dwindling meat supplies.
A lot of health problems today are blamed on our love of grains and starches and how many of our calories we take in from these kinds of foods. For those without a biological intolerance, is it still better to minimize consumption of things like wheat and rice?
I think it depends on the lifestyle. And if people have sufficiently active lifestyle, if they're able to walk around something on the order of 2 hours a day, then the evidence suggests that you can eat pretty well what you like. And so any sort of traditional cuisine would have sufficed. And some of those traditional cuisines were quite heavy in starches, and some of them were based largely on meat. But our bodies were designed to eat a lot of different kinds of foods while we're having with a lot of physical activity to accompany it. And so I think as long as you're going with some sort of traditional cuisine, then you can eat as little or as much starch as you prefer.
How is it that you manage to teach and write books and walk for at least 2 hours every day?
So as a writer, you don't have a large salary, and you end up walking a lot instead of taking more expensive forms of transportation. Mm. And it turns out, walking, it's not really that expensive. You can just put on a pair of shoes, or if you want, you can walk barefoot, actually. I try to do that as much as possible. So there, you don't even need shoes, and you need to get outside.
Stephen Lay is my guest. He's visiting professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Ottawa and author of the new book, 100 Million Years of Food, What Our Ancestors Ate and Why It Matters Today. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Stephen Lay, who is visiting professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Ottawa and author of a new book called 100 Million Years of Food, What Our Ancestors Ate and Why It Matters Today. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Steve, these days most Americans have absorbed the message that we really should be eating a large amount of fruits and vegetables every single day, even if we sometimes fail to follow that advice. But evolutionary history, you tell us, suggests that we are not meant to gorge on fruit.
Yes, that's right. So one of the most fascinating occurrences in the evolution of the, of humans is that we lost the ability to break down uric acid. And so what this means is that when we consume large amounts of fructose, this can be pretty dangerous for our health. And there's a complicated history behind this, but what it looks like then is that even though in our long past we were able to consume large amounts of fruits, more recently in history, we've lost the ability to safely consume large amounts of fructose, which is the sugar in fruits. And so nutritionists today recommend that we eat a lot of fruits. And that to a large extent, that's still fine. The danger is when we eat concentrated amounts of fructose. And so nowadays, a lot of people are becoming aware that high fructose corn syrup is something to be aware of and to be avoided in things like soft drinks. And so eating fruits, you get a lot of fiber, you get there's a lot of water in it, and so the amount of fructose that we eat in that is probably not such a dangerous thing. But as the amounts of fructose become more concentrated, then it's something to be aware of.
And an all-fruit diet might not be a good idea.
That's right. So Steve Jobs named his company after apples because he, according to his biographer, he worked in an orchard with apples, and he was fond of all fruit regimes, and it's speculated then that this could have been harmful for him and could have been a factor in his death as well, and it's also known that the actor who played Steve Jobs in his in a recent movie, he trying to simulate the role of Steve Jobs, he also tried eating a lot of fruits and was eventually hospitalized. So it looks like having a large fruit diet is not a good thing. And it's also known that, for example, bears will try to avoid eating large amounts of fruits if possible. It's just not something that we're really good at doing.
So they like fruit, they just will eat it along with other things that they're consuming.
That's correct.
Why don't our bodies make vitamin C the way they make vitamin D?
So we can't trace that exactly, but it looks like we lost this ability over time, probably because we were exposed to large amounts of fruits at one point in our diet. And so animals that have this exposure lose the ability to make vitamin C. And it makes sense at that particular time. So what happens, though, later on in time, if they lose access to that amount of, to fruit or to larger quantities of vitamin C, then in some cases they can subsequently redevelop through evolution the ability to produce vitamin C. However, it's a pretty it requires several genetic changes for this for the ability of vitamin C to be produced. And in the case of humans, it looks like uric acid is actually our substitute for vitamin C. And uric acid and vitamin C seem to have similar properties in terms of being antioxidants.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Pam on the line in Denton. Hello, Pam.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
What does the professor think about the blood type diets that are supposed to trace back to our nomadic ancestry?
And how does this diet work?
The nomads that lived in certain areas, they ate a particular diet, and I've read articles that say that finding out our blood type and eating those types of food will cause longevity.
Okay, that's an interesting hypothesis. I haven't read of any hard evidence, scientific evidence, to support a diet that is tailored to your blood type. Theoretically, it's possible, but I guess there would have to be more evidence to convince me.
I want to talk about vitamin D because, of course, our bodies can synthesize this from sun exposure, but depending on the color of our skin and where we live, some people might need more sun than others.
Yes, that's right. So in the long history of humans, we developed different skin types to accommodate the amount of sun that we were exposed to. And darker skin in the tropical latitudes and lighter skin for Northern Europeans, for example. And with this skin type, then when people were outside constantly, they got the right amount of skin exposure. And from that, our skin was able to produce vitamin D. In recent times, when people have been moving around the world a lot, we end up with mismatched skin types. And for example, my skin tans quite easily. And so when I'm in a place like Canada, I'm relatively dark and I get I don't get enough vitamin D, particularly in the winter. And this goes for a lot of dark-skinned people living in northern latitudes.
And on the other hand, you know, my skin is very Irish and I was not made to live in Texas and I worry about skin cancer. Should I think about not getting enough vitamin D if I'm using a lot of sunscreen?
Yes, that's it's a dilemma for sure, because if you are in this kind of situation, then using a lot of sunscreen is going to reduce the amount of vitamin D that your skin can produce. Taking vitamin D supplements allows you to overcome this problem to an extent. The problem then is that our body has no means of regulating vitamin D that's taken orally. It's possible that you're getting enough vitamin D. When you take it through supplements, it's possible you're not getting enough, and it's possible that you're taking too much. And so that's the trade-off from living in an environment that's not well-matched for your skin type. And this is something that a lot of white Australians also face as well.
What's the relationship between proper or improper vitamin D levels, optimal vitamin D levels, and allergies?
Yes, there's a series of studies now that suggest that allergies such as food allergies could be at increased risk if you don't have high enough vitamin D levels, and particularly for young children, and particularly for mothers who are pregnant. And so, at that age, pregnant women and children may want to get enough vitamin D so that they can avoid the incidence of food allergies in the future of the child. However, we're still at the preliminary stages of understanding what it is, the mechanisms between vitamin D and food allergies. It may turn out to be the case that it's simply the vitamin D that's responsible for preventing food allergies, but it could also turn out to be something else in the sunlight. There's something else in the interaction between sunlight and skin is helping to reduce the food allergy incidence, and the vitamin D is just a secondary kind of indicator, just a some sort of side effect. We're not sure yet exactly about the link between sunlight and food allergies, but we do know that people who live in sunnier places have lower incidences of food allergies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone to Sterling in Plano. Hi, Sterling.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I apologize for the background noise. I'm driving hands-free, but hopefully this comes through. I wanted to ask the person speaking today if there's anything in his book or if he knows anything research-wise regarding our diets as it relates to if we grow our own gardens at home, herb gardens or even vegetable gardens, much more even compost, how much that actually impacts our diet. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So there's two possible benefits here. First of all, just being outside and gardening, being physically active, probably means you are able to have better health and eat a widely varied diet. So you can enjoy your food if you're being physically active, and so on. That, and from that point of view, it's a good idea to get out and garden and grow your own vegetables and fruits. As for the quality of the food, it depends on how you're gardening. I guess if you're not using a lot of chemicals, then you can feel safer about the food that you're eating from your own garden. And then beyond that, it's a question of context. So if you're eating those vegetables in a traditional kind of cuisine, then you'll end up not having to worry about lacking any nutrients. So I think it's a good idea overall.
Vegetables certainly can deliver a lot of nutrients, but your take on them is more complicated than what many of us may have heard, not least of which is the fact that, you know, we settled on the vegetables we eat because we found that we could eat them without, you know, dying of some kind of poisonous toxin within them.
Yes. These days, vegetables are considered to be the best food to eat by nutritionists. And so a lot of us head to salad bars and we pat ourselves on the back because we think we're doing a good thing for ourselves. And the interesting thing is that if you ask people living in traditional societies whether they like to eat vegetables, then almost invariably they'll say no. And they would much prefer to eat meat and a lot of fat along with that meat. And some salt too, please. So the reason is because plants protect themselves with all sorts of toxins. And so if you eat too many vegetables, then you feel sick. You know, the plants are doing their job. Over time, in different parts of the world, people have learned how to process plant foods so that they taste reasonably well in a diet. But inevitably, when people have a chance, as soon as the societies become rich enough and they get their hands on meat, then they start to eat meat and they eat less vegetables. And children know this as well. Children instinctively push away vegetables, particularly bitter vegetables. And in terms of the health benefits, it's quite interesting that in proportion to the urgency or the enthusiasm that nutritionists push vegetables, there hasn't been a lot of evidence to suggest that vegetables are actually that good for us in terms of, let's say, extending our lifespan. So perhaps in the future, let's say 100 years from now, nutritionists then in the future may look back and laugh at the way that nutritionists today strongly promote vegetable foods.
I was really interested to read your chapter about fish. It makes sense that it would be more of a staple in places where it's plentiful, but a surprising number of cultures develop taboos against eating fish. What accounts for that?
Yes, there's several reasons, possible reasons. First of all, we all know about fish having bones, and children dread fish for this reason. And so in that sense, it makes... it's reasonable that we should avoid eating fish. And then if you get past the bones, then fish often are lean. And again, as I mentioned earlier, humans have a limited ability to digest protein. And so because fish are lean, people in traditional societies tried to avoid eating lean fish. When fish were fatty, such as in salmon runs on the Pacific coast, in those cases they could eat large amounts of salmon. But then another drawback, potential drawback with eating large amounts of seafood in general is that you get a lot of vitamin D. You might think that's a good thing, but people in traditional societies were already outside all day getting a lot of vitamin D. And so getting too much vitamin D would have been a bad thing and it can actually make you sick. And then the final consequence is that seafood and fish have a lot of omega-3s, fatty acids. And again, we think of this today as a good thing, but our ancestors had enough omega-3 fatty acids to deal with. And so for them to have too much omega-3 fatty acids meant that there was a increased probability of prolonged bleeding, for example. And so for them, fish was not their favorite food. generally speaking.
Okay, Steve. Now, if someone has been listening to us, you know, half listening, you know, they've heard you say you're not supposed to eat too many fruits. You shouldn't have too much meat and dairy. You need to be careful about, you know, there's not evidence that vegetables are necessarily the be-all and end-all. Fish can be overdone. It sounds like, on the one hand, it sounds like you're saying nothing is good for you. On the other hand, the message could be what we really need is a combination of all these things in moderate amounts.
Yes, I think that's right. So all foods have their drawbacks in different ways. If people are eating traditional diets and traditional cuisines, then these nutrients are balanced with each other. The sort of bigger trade-off, though, is that eating a lot of meat can make somebody feel great. Having cholesterol can boost their mood and their sex drive. And that seems like a good thing, except for the trade-off, which is that it's possible that eating too much or eating a lot of red meat could shorten a person's lifespan. And this seems like it's a difficult dilemma for us to deal with, but from a biological standpoint, it makes perfect sense because in biology, organisms have trade-offs. They either live long or they have shorter but more robust lives. And so this is a consequence of evolution.
Unfortunately for human beings, we want both, right? We want
That's right.
robust lives and we want them to last a very long time.
That's right.
You're skeptical about anything called a superfood, with the possible exception of moderate amounts of alcohol every day.
Yes. The strongest evidence for any food in terms of reducing disease is alcohol. And we've known this for a long time, that drinking moderate amounts of alcohol can reduce the risk of heart disease. On the other hand, there's all sorts of consequences, potential consequences, such as increasing the risk of violent incidents, driving off the road, getting into fights, and getting addicted to alcohol. And in that case, even drinking way too much. That's more than we need for our good health.
Let the trade-offs continue. My guest is Stephen Lay, visiting professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Ottawa and author of the book 100 Million Years of Food, What Our Ancestors Ate and Why It Matters Today. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can email us at think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Stephen Lay, who is a biological anthropologist and author of a new book called 100 Million Years of Food, What Our Ancestors Ate and Why It Matters Today. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Steve, I want to talk about what traditional diets really means, because we hear this term and you could think traditional diets, is that what, you know, my great-grandparents ate 100 years ago? Is it from 1,000 years ago? How far back do we have to go to gain the benefits of traditional eating?
I think if you take a look at a map, throw a dart, and then dial the clock 500 years back, then there's that's a traditional diet in the sense that I'm talking about in the book. At that point in time, there weren't a lot of processed foods available, if any. By processed, I mean in this case, factory-made foods. So those kind of diets are the diets that our bodies are reasonably well adjusted to. The more recent diets then have introduction of things like refined flour, white bread, white rice, MSG, sugar, and so on. And so our bodies become less and less capable of handling these diets as we get closer in time.
We have an email from Kelly who wants to know, does each of us have an ideal diet determined by our genetic inheritance and geographic provenance? In other words, is there a health cost to adopting a diet radically different than that of our cultural ancestors?
Yes. So theoretically speaking, if you submitted your genes to a company and they found out exactly what your genotype was, and we knew all the diseases that were associated with your genes, then in theory, a scientist could tailor a perfect diet for that person based on their genes. We don't have that technology available yet, and it's very expensive, and it's still developing. So for most of us, we just have to guess. Now, if you look at your ancestry, and if you know where your ancestors come from, then eating what your ancestors ate makes perfect sense. You can avoid potential diseases that way. It becomes more complicated for people who have mixed ancestry. And then it becomes a dilemma of which traditional diet are you going to look back to. And so in that case, yeah, you could dial the clock further back and look for something that's common to all the ancestors, and which is why the paleo diet has become so popular.
How important is it that the food in these traditional diets tastes good to us?
For the most part, people in traditional societies were able to create diets that tasted well to them, mm-hmm. and they could get by in those diets. They weren't necessarily super happy about those diets, though. And for example, we know that the diet in Crete today, nutritionists look at this diet as being the epitome of the Mediterranean diet. They use a lot of olive oil, a lot of vegetables, and a little bit of dairy, and not much red meat, and some seafood as well, and a lot of nuts. Yeah. So it looks like a great diet. But when people actually surveyed the people living on Crete decades ago, they all said they wanted to shift away from their diet, and they wanted to eat more meat. And so as soon as the people became rich enough, they moved away from their traditional diet and probably became less healthy as a result. And so our taste can guide us to a certain extent, and if we stay away from the more recent foods, then eating tasty traditional diets is a great thing. Taste can be misleading when we encounter more recent foods, and especially processed foods that are designed to taste good to us and are cheap to buy, but they're not good for us to eat.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Dexter in Dallas. Hi, Dexter.
Hi there. Hi, Chris. Hi, Steve. My question is, would you please comment on the modern adaptation of fasting with reference to that ancient people or ancient, the diet included numbers of days that they actually don't eat. And if you could comment also on which would you recommend, or different regimes, it seems. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about fasting, Steve?
Yeah, fasting is very popular these days. And it's quite likely that our ancestors involuntarily had to fast whenever they were not able to find enough food. So it's quite reasonable that we have we're adapted to periodic fasting. So the question then is, are there concrete health benefits associated with fasting? And because this trend has been so recent, the studies are just starting to come out now. And the trend so far seems hopeful. It seems positive that we're getting health benefits from occasional fasting. But that being said, there's probably drawbacks as well. And so in the book, I looked at the drawbacks of reducing the caloric intake overall. And in that case, it's quite likely that people end up with, for example, reduced sex drive from depriving themselves of food. And so it depends on the amount of fasting that's being done, the quantity of fasting, and so on. In moderation, though, it seems like a good idea. I don't do it myself voluntarily, but then again, as a writer, you end up sometimes involuntarily fasting, and I don't see any negative effects so far.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Manu on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Manu.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, going back to the traditions, what is your take on clarified butter, popularly called a desi ghee, that we were raised back home in India but apparently it's back again that everybody is recommending in diets these days.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, that's a good, great question. Animal fats in general are coming back. They're more popular now, and they're getting more recognition among nutritionists. Before, people were afraid of animal fats because of the saturated fats that they carried. And for a long time, for decades, there was a stigma associated with saturated fats due to their nutritionists believe that there was a link between heart diseases and saturated fats. Because that evidence, though, hasn't really been that strong over the past few decades, more and more people are scientists and doctors are allowing or recommending even people to use animal fats. So, for example, ghee, butter, lard are becoming more popular and accepted by nutritionists.
Many people want to eat the right thing and are not exactly sure what to do. And, you know, they sort of, you know, if you walk into any bookstore, there are thousands of volumes on the shelves. In terms of just, you know, lay people kind of understanding all this information, what do you suggest to people who want to make good choices but see a lot of conflicting information out there?
Yes, I think this is quite unfortunate. This is something that a lot of my friends and family are going through. You go to the bookstore and there's a lot of contradictory evidence from people who have a lot of experience and authority in this area. And so it's quite unfortunate that the public has been so confused about what to eat. I then would recommend that people look to see what their ancestors were eating. It's your choice about how far you want to go back in time. Eating those kind of traditional cuisines, they quite likely tasted better than what people are eating today. It's not salad bar fare. It's traditional foods incorporate a lot of animal foods in them, and they tasted well to those people at that time. So going back in time makes sense from just feeling better about what you eat. And in terms of the science behind it, we can be quite reasonable, reasonably assured that traditional diets do a good job in protecting our health.
This is really interesting. When I read this in the book, we know that there are health benefits to good hygiene, right? But there are also some drawbacks to sterilizing our environments, to making our lives too free of microbes and even parasites.
Right. And when we end up with these living in sterile environments, there's a plausible link between that and increased risk of things like allergies. And so there's a trade-off there. Very few doctors these days are recommending that people get more exposure to germs. But it's quite possible then that not having any exposure to diseases makes our immune systems too sensitive. And we end up with disease like Crohn's disease. So there are some new therapies being developed. For example, people are looking at looking for parasites that don't hurt us, but can help us to develop our immune systems properly. So that's the real goal here. If we can find those kind of parasites, then we can get both benefits. We can avoid having serious infectious diseases, but we can also allow our immune systems to develop properly so that we can avoid allergic diseases. But these new medicines, which consist of live parasites, are still in the testing stage, and so hopefully they'll be developed soon. In the meanwhile, people are moving in different directions. Some people think, okay, let's just wait for the doctors to develop the proper medication. Other people are going ahead and looking for parasites and actively either getting those parasites or avoiding things like vaccinations. And that's a lot riskier, as you can imagine.
We have an email from Joey in Denton who asks, wouldn't it be the most logical course for our growing global population to harness the small environmental footprint and high protein content of insects?
Yes. And I personally really enjoy eating insects, and I've tried introducing insect foods to a lot of people, and sometimes I'm quite surprised about how disgusted people are. For example, there's a when I was visiting a farm in near Washington D.C. It was owned by Sally Fallon Morrell, who's a writer in about traditional foods, and I bought some cricket bars from her store, and these are produced in the United States. They taste just like Clif bars. They have this peanutty taste. They're quite delicious and so on. But when I try to get my other people to eat them, there's a lot of negative reactions. Even though they look fine, they taste fine, but just the association with crickets makes people turned off.
Is there anything that you won't eat as like a matter of principle or just because you think it's too bad for you? Anything that you outright would never touch?
If I know that somebody else has eaten the same, that particular food and has not died, I will try it.
And when you travel and you're looking to either travel for pleasure and you're just observing or you're traveling professionally, how do you trace back what traditional diets look like? Are you able to extrapolate based on people living in relatively simple conditions today? Can you tell what their ancestors were eating?
It depends on which part of the world. Unfortunately, most traditional diets have radically changed over the last century. And so it's quite difficult to reconstruct based on just traveling around. That being said, there are some parts of the world where you can get a reasonable approximation of how people used to eat. And so, for example, I had a wonderful surprise in Laos in a city, a small town called Luang Prabang. And there was a restaurant there run by a Laotian Australian couple. And as part of their on their menu, they have this adventurous, I think it's called the Adventure Platter. If you order this in advance, then they'll go to the market the next morning and find whatever is in the market. And this will include frogs, snakes, and bitter vegetables, and so on. And so you can get quite a reasonable approximation of what people used to eat like in that case. Laos is special because they still retain a lot of their jungles, which are unfortunately rapidly disappearing. But in most parts of the world, the environments have been so radically changed that it's really hard to find people who still eat traditionally.
Do you think we're moving toward this as people start to understand more about nutrition, or do you think that traditional diets are going to be just used by a very tiny, specialized segment of the population moving forward?
I believe that in the next couple of years, there will be a strong push to go back to traditional diets, because the health benefits of eating scientifically approved nutritional diets, the evidence is not that strong, and the taste difference is quite marked. So I think people will be going back towards traditional diets because they taste better, they do as good of a job as maintaining health as other diets. So I think that's the trend.
Biological anthropologist Stephen Lay is visiting professor at the University of Ottawa and author of the new book, 100 Million Years of Food, What Our Ancestors Ate and Why It Matters Today. Steve, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.